so we will move on directly to the second session, which is about index. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear me. About index insurance. So we had in the previous talk an example of index insurance at the country level. And as you probably know, this index insurance can also happen at a very local scale for farmers, for smallholders. So globally, it's a new product. It started maybe at the beginning of the 21st century. So now we have at least 15 years of experience on index insurance, what is working, what is not working. And this is why Michael first will give you a bit an overview, a review of what is working and what is not working in index insurance. And second, Alain de Genvry will try to combine index insurance with other risk-reducing products. So first, Michael, who is like a professor at the University of California at Davis and also director of BASIS, which is an innovation lab, right? Am I right? And Alain is a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and also senior fellow at the FERDI. So, Michael, if you want to start, you have 17 minutes.
Exactly 17 minutes. Good. Let's see what we can do in 17 minutes while I try to speak slowly, respecting the translators. Okay, I want to speak to you a little bit about what we're learning about what can make index insurance work. So I'm going to talk a little bit about micro and meso level. We just brought that up. I'm not going to try to connect it to the discussion we just had, but it's clearly something I think we need to think about. So before talking about what works, I want to say just a couple of words about what I will describe as the potential of index insurance and also the problems of index insurance. So let me start with the potential, and let me start with the final bullet point, because I think it connects nicely to what we just heard from Daniel and Alejandro. So what we've seen, and I'm going to, in your USB stick, you received some material looking at a specific project in Kenya. And what we found there after the drought of 2011 were individuals, pastoralists, they lost roughly 45% of their assets over just the period of a couple of months. Very large insurance payments were triggered, and we took advantage of an experiment we had going on to determine the impacts of this. And basically what you see is rather like what we saw at the municipality level. We see the asset levels of households that are insured are substantially above those of households that were not insured. But here we're not talking about water systems or road systems. We're actually talking about their core productive assets. So we found that the insurance payments for those who were in the experimental zone allowed them to radically reduce the amount of sort of distress sales of their assets. Okay, and this is huge because that's saying that these families exited the drought event. They suffered the same losses. They were in the same place as the people without insurance, but they exited with a much more stable economic foundation. And this is an area of the world where we believe something called a poverty trap exists. And if your assets fall too low, then you become stuck for a long, long time. So the budgetary implication of this is actually quite profound because it suggests that without insurance, some fraction of those people hit by the result actually become poor. They become eligible for existing social assistance programs. And keeping them above that critical threshold is really important. The other thing we find from a couple of studies of the same event is that not only did it help people hold on to their productive assets, but it helped prevent them from drawing down basically on the future productive capacity of their children. Because one of the things we find in this area is that the poorer households respond to the drought not so much by selling off their assets. They don't want to sell off their final assets because that would be a stupid strategy. So instead what they do is they eat less. Okay? And so if you think about the consequences of that, especially for the productive potential of children, it's actually quite profound. So again, we found from this macabre experiment, if you will, we found that the impact of insurance on families' reliance on eating less was quite profound and large. And you can even measure it. The part of our research measured middle upper arm circumference on children under five. And those children experienced much less of a reduction, literally, in their physical characteristics, which is, you know, which signifies this, which signifies the fact these families were not relying on reducing consumption as much. And again, it's not so much the physical stature. We're not interested in big biceps, right? But as is well known in the medical and the nutrition literature, if you're looking at the stature of a child or the middle upper arm circumference of a child, the reason people look at young children is because that also correlates with their mental development. And if children are not eating properly, especially under the ages of about three, they never have full cognitive development of their brain. So the long-term consequences of that, of dealing with disasters by eating less, are really quite profound and spill over the generations. So that's the potential of dealing with shocks after the drought. The other side of it, and it's the second to last bullet point up, if people feel more secure that after a bad event happens, their capital will be protected, their families will be protected, we might anticipate that they will change their behavior before the drought. And again, here there's a handful of studies, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 studies, that show that when you give small-scale farmers in particular good risk reduction instruments, they actually intensify their investments in very productive kinds of technology. So, say, in one I worked on in the country of Mali with cotton farmers, we found that the provision of insurance increased investment by about 30 to 35%. Okay? And that's really quite a remark, that implies a very remarkably large increase in the family income of these households simply by pulling risk out of the system. So it's in that sense, these, you think about both of these things together at the household level, that to me is the potential of index insurance. So that's the good side of the picture. Okay, the bad side of the picture is index insurance is a work in progress. There are a lot of problems, a lot of studies, including some of my own, have suffered with terribly low uptake of the insurance, sometimes so low that we can't even really infer anything about the impacts of the insurance. And I want to focus on a couple of problems and then sort of come back to what we're learning about solving these problems. One of the problems is that many index insurance contracts are of intrinsically low quality. That is, they're highly failure prone. That is, if you ask what's the probability that the contract will pay out if the farmer has a disaster, I think for many of the rainfall-based index insurance contract, the answer is less than a 50% probability. That is, they're failing probably more than they're working. And that's not good. The price of that insurance is often high. I'm not going to talk much about that. Issues of lack of trust in providers, I do want to talk about that. And then there are other issues about lack of information on a complex technology, cash constraints to purchasing. Those two problems in particular have encouraged some people to think about meso-level insurance. And I will say just a little bit about that. And I won't talk about my favorite thing that I've sort of strangely, must have been jet lag in my brain, I hear described as behavioral oddities. We won't really talk about that, but we could if anyone wonders what I might mean by that. So let's just jump right in and talk about what have we been learning about progress towards these potentials. So I'm going to focus just on these first three sub-bullet points. I want to talk about technological advances to create higher quality insurance indices. So I think it's becoming increasingly doable, but we need to face up to the limitations of what we have. And second, I think we need to think about what I call here safe minimum standards for index insurance quality, because if there is no certification, even if we have a higher quality contract, no one knows it, no one trusts it. And then in the end, go back a step, why should anybody invest in creating that higher quality contract if no one's going to believe it's higher quality? So I think we have a real issue there. And finally, as I said, I want to talk a little bit about interlinked and meso-level insurance contracts as a way to possibly overcome some of these constraints or limitations. Some of you may have heard of what are sometimes, to me, euphemistically called basis risk events. That basically means you have a whole bunch of farmers who are really angry because they thought they had insurance and they didn't get paid. So what are the sources of this kind of failure? I think there are two, and I think it's important to keep them in mind. One is what I like to call design risk, and that's when an insurance index is poorly correlated with average, emphasis on average, losses in a community. So the index itself is actually a poor predictor of even the typical experience. And then you have what we might call individual or idiosyncratic risk. And that's when the experience of one person is different than the average in their community. Okay? And an index insurance contract is not designed to meet that. So the question is, how do we do that? So how can we improve the situation and reduce the results of this? So I want to give you a concrete example that's going to focus primarily on reducing design risk, so making a better quality contract so it's more likely to cover all the average loss events. And I'm going to call that a fail-safe index insurance contract. But the other issue we're going to talk about, and I'm not going to try to explain this beautiful diagram because I think it will take too many of my 17 minutes, but it's also the scale of the contract. So if this, in a sense, we can shrink idiosyncratic risk if we can shrink down the scale of the contract. In the extreme, if an index only covers my production, then there is no idiosyncratic risk. Okay. Now, we may not want to shrink down to that level, but there are sort of clever ways to start shrinking the scale of contracts so we begin to minimize or reduce at least the level of idiosyncratic risk. So I want to focus real quickly here that on some ideas that we've been pursuing in a current project, a big randomized control trial we have in Tanzania and Mozambique. The overall desire here, it's actually an experiment involving drought-tolerant maize seeds, which we get from CIMMYT. So this is work with the International Center for the Improvement of Maize and Wheat, and insurance. And the idea of it is that drought-tolerant seeds are drought-tolerant, but they are not drought-proof. So they protect farmers against some risk, but they don't protect against other risks. So the insurance contract has been tailored to protect farmers against an early season rainfall deficit, because if you have early season rainfall deficit, then even drought-tolerant seeds don't germinate and don't do anything for the farmer. And it's also designed to protect against end-of-season yield deficits that could come from a variety of sources. The contract is based really, and I'm going to skip over a lot of this, it's based on a rainfall index for the early season, and it's based on an NDVI or biomass growth measure for the end of season deficit. If you're not familiar with NDVI, this is just a composite picture of our insurance area in Tanzania between 2014 and 2015. These pictures actually come from about 70 days into the growing season from each of those 2 years. 2014 was a pretty good year. 2015 was not, and you can just sort of see it in the greenness measure there. Okay? So right now we're working, the pixel resolution we're working with is 250 meters by 250 meters, so let's call that roughly 6 hectares. I'll briefly say something about using higher resolution imagery, which we've gotten from a private company called Planet Labs, which is 3 meter by 3 meter resolution. So that's what I mean by downscaling. I may not really be able to go into that. So how does this contract work? So just very quickly, there are two triggers, and if either one is triggered, then farmers receive the indemnity payment. There's a rainfall trigger, which I show on the horizontal axis. So if the measured rainfall is to the left of that vertical red line, then a payment occurs. And then there's an end-of-season yield trigger based on the biomass estimated model of yields that we've done. And that triggers when end-of-season yields are estimated to be below 60% of their average for the locality. Okay. Now, all the dots that are on there and the different shapes that are on there, that comes from our ground truthing data. Okay. So nobody really knows what maize yields look like lots of places. And so we said, well, at least bad information is probably better than no information. So we've been working on methods to retrospectively collect yield data from farmers and then use that data to be able to judge the quality of an index insurance contract, indeed to design an index insurance contract that's high quality. So if you can see the red triangles like these, those are instances when those are sort of village year combinations when yields were actually quite low, below 60% of average for that area. So those are instances in which farmers deserve to be indemnified under the terms of our contract. Now, if you notice, most of those red triangles are actually here, which means in those years, they would have been indemnified. Okay, so the contract works. However, if you look closely, there are two little red triangles there, okay, where historically this contract would have failed those farmers. In other words, their yields were below 60% of normal, but neither one of the triggers would have triggered, and they would not have been compensated. Those are sort of basis risk events, okay? So what we've done is we say, okay, this is pretty good. We're actually covering about 80% of the variation that farmers face in yields, but not all of it. And so we know that those happen. So what we have set up in these two countries is an SMS system so that we tell farmers whether or not payouts are going to occur. If they do not occur and farmers feel like in their community yields are below 60%, they send an SMS message basically saying, your insurance contract is horrible. Okay? And if at least 30% of farmers complain, then we are obligated to send out a team on the ground to go to their community and actually do a particular variation on a crop cut audit. It's a very high-tech thing. I won't sort of bother about that, but it involves use of photography, and it's much more, I think it's much faster than what way these things are typically done. So we call this fail safe because we're saying we know that even though we did our very best effort to design a responsible index insurance contract, at the scale we're operating at, there is some failure. And in fact, our data allow us to estimate that failure probability. So this is an example table that I actually originally put together for Swiss Re that's providing the reinsurance for this contract. And what you will see is we price in, as part of the pricing model, we put in the probability that the contract will fail. Those are in our historical data, those were those two red triangles you saw a moment ago. We know how much it costs when they fail, and then that's rolled into the premium. Okay, so the total premium is the result of both the triggered events, but the untriggered events that would trigger an audit. Okay, so part of what I want to say is if you're sort of pursuing a quality contract, that gives you a lot of options to recognize first to see the imperfection in the index insurance contract, and secondly, actually propose a remedy for that. The next point I want to make, and I only have a few minutes left, so I will start to accelerate but not talk fast, is the importance of safe minimum standards. I want to give Daniel Clark a lot of credit for a paper he wrote a couple of years ago that really got me thinking about this. Let me just focus on the middle point here. Every country I go to has a certified seed standard. And seeds have what economists like to call an invisible trait. Okay, you can look at that maize seed, but you don't know what the genes are inside of it. You can just see that it's a maize seed. You know, some maize seed companies will spray their maize with different colors so people can say, oh, that purple seed, that's actually this company. But fundamentally, nobody really knows. So most countries, therefore, regulate seed certification and their yield tests and their germination tests. And for a seed to be certified and stamped, it has to meet certain standards. Well, index insurance is a similar kind of problem with a hidden trait. I showed you a picture a few slides back of a woman in Turkana in northern Kenya holding her TACAFOL-compliant index insurance contract from our work in Kenya. Okay, she's got that piece of paper in her hand, but looking at that paper does not tell her what the probability is that that contract will or will not fail her. And there is no certification of that standard. In fact, there is no standard. Just there are yield standards, there are germination standards for certified maize seeds, but we do not have those standards for index insurance contracts. There's obviously regulation of them, but typically the regulation focuses on the financial stability of the company, not the quality of the contract per se. So just to give you an idea, we've used some basic economics to create what we call a safe minimum standard for index insurance, and it's simply an aggregation of how often the contract fails and whether it fails when people are really desperate or just fails when they're a little bit desperate. So it's just a way of aggregating those two kind of loss indicators together. And the safe minimum standard is we can use those statistical characteristics of the contract to say what's the maximum anybody should be willing to pay for that contract. What's the most they could pay without making themselves worse off? And if the price if the maximum they could pay is $10, and the price is $12, then they would be better off doing something with their $12. Or the government would be better off just giving them the $12 if the government, in fact, is paying for it. So I personally think that we need to keep pushing this frontier on quality of contract, but I think there's also an important public role to make it worthwhile to make those investments and give certainty or surety to insured farmers that they know what they're buying. So we need to find out that. The final thing I wanted to mention was just a little bit on meso-level insurance. So again, as I mentioned, often people feel that it's time to stop, right? Yeah. So often, but give me 1 minute. So often people feel that uptake is low because the understanding is poor, and maybe it would be better to sell it to a financial institution. That's a really interesting idea. I would just throw in two words of caution. Number one, if part of the reason for being interested in insurance is because we think it will crowd an investment, then that's not going to happen unless the protected farmer understands that he or she is protected. And so that's an issue that needs to be dealt with. The other issue is if one of the weaknesses of index insurance contracts is design risk, then you need a good contract even to protect the portfolio of a lender, say a microfinance lender, or if the protection is being offered to a value chain agent, then again, contract quality remains really important. There's a little bit more to say. There's a few pilot projects out there on these meso-level insurance. There's some interesting findings that are in that literature. I won't bother to say anything about that. But again, so to close, I think the age-old problem of risk and resilience are strong. We've had a lot of interesting discussion today with AFD about attention to those issues. Even USAID, who I was in a meeting with them earlier this week, these issues are front and center within their own thinking. So I think as we go forward, I guess I'm a very stubborn person. A lot of people have given up on index insurance at the micro level. I've sort of seen what it can do. I've seen the evolving sort of technological options, and at least I'm stubbornly kind of continuing on to see if we can make it work better. So thank you very much, and thanks for your patience with my long-windedness.
Thanks a lot, Michael. So now we will move on directly to your talk, Alan. So about combining index insurance with other risk-reducing instruments.
So like Michael, I have been working quite a bit on index insurance, and it came about to us as an idea after some time that maybe we were overselling index insurance and we should use other risk-reducing, risk-management instruments in complement to index insurance and to confine index insurance to where really it can work. So what I'm going to present to you today is basically three studies we have done. The first one is using resilient technology. The second is to use an indexed loan for emergency situation. And the third one is to use index insurance as a social safety net. And at the end, what I'm going to argue is that we need to use those different instruments as a portfolio and place this sort of pure index insurance, which is sold individually, as just one element of this portfolio of instruments. So what we know is that there is very low demand at market prices. This is a demand function for index insurance that is coming from different of the ATAI studies that we manage out of Berkeley and MIT. And what you see on the right-hand side is that there is 100% uptake at 100% subsidy, but as soon as you raise the price and when you start to reach the market price, then the effective demand falls to about 10% of the potential clientele. Right? So many reasons have been identified for the low take-up. Michael has listed them and explored some solutions to this. The proposition here is that we need to look as to how to optimally combine index insurance with other risk-reducing instruments. Right? I'm using here a table that comes from Daniel's book, which is that basically risk can be either transferred or retained. The small risks, which are kind of low frequency, the high frequency events, I'm starting with the bottom, with kind of minor impact should be handled with risk retention through precautionary savings, through risk reducing technology, or through pre-approved credit lines. When the severity of impact becomes larger and the frequency of events become lower, then we shift to index insurance and at the limit to aid and the social safety net. So index insurance is actually bracketed by other instruments, and this is what I want to explore in this particular presentation. I'm using a conceptual framework, I call it the theory of change. it's implicitly the same as what Daniel has using and explicitly the one that Michael has been using. Namely, when a shock happens, you have sort of exposed and ex ante. Exposed, you have coping with the shock, which could be decapitalization, reducing consumption, etc. Right? And usually when people think about instruments to face to the issue of risk, they think about the risk coping dimension, right? At the same time, when people know that they are going to be covered for risk, they are going to reoptimize, and behavior becomes a very important issue. And the reoptimization is that you are going to do things differently, knowing that you are going to be covered in case of a bad shock. You can invest more, you can take risk, you can change your portfolio of investment towards higher expected return, though higher risk options, right? And in the long term, it's quite interesting that the total value of introducing a risk-reducing instrument may be just as big on the risk-coping side, which is the one that we think about traditionally, as it is on the risk-management side. And so it's very important to understand behavior. It's very important to induce behavior. And this is a question to Daniel, is when you talked about sort of inducing positive moral hazards, is how do you do that, right? So let me talk about three situations. The first one is technology. This is a case of risk-reducing technology in terms of flood resistance. A new rice variety called Suana Sabuana or scuba rice, which is kind of holding its breath under water for about 14 days. So this is the we do a randomized controlled trials. We have a counterfactual variety, which is here in blue. It's called Suana. Suana Sabuana is genetically modified, but not food. It's not a GMO. It's via traditional breeding, to insert a gene which is going to help the variety with then flooding for about 15 days. And you see that when you are, so the horizontal axis, you have the length of days of flooding, and you see that when you are kind of 14, 15 days, you have about 45% advantage in terms of yield, right? So the risk coping value is basically this risk, so this is ex post relative to shock, is the fact that you are going to have less of a yield loss, which is about 682 kilograms per hectare when you have this 10 to 15 days submersion. However, farmers now know that they are going to be protected, and they do something very interesting, which is they are going to reoptimize in terms of behavior. They're going to take more risks. And so what we see, observing what they do, randomized control trial in a normal year, first year there was flooding, second year there was no flooding, first year they learned what the technology offered to them in terms of risk reduction, second year they just reoptimize what they do. And what we see, they cultivate more land. They use more, less traditional but resilient low-yield varieties. They use more fertilizer. They use more labor-intensive planting methods. And at the end, year after year, good year after good year, knowing that a bad year is going to be avoided, you have an increase in yield of about 283 kilograms per hectare. So that gives us something very interesting, which is the fact that, say, if you have one bad year every 4 years and 3 years, three normal years, you have actually more gain from the normal years than you have from the bad years. And so behavior buys you more in terms of outcome than the risk-reducing technology that you have been producing for that purpose, which is what the agronomists are doing. And so us kind of behaviorists come into play and then multiply by two the return from investing in those risk-reducing instruments, right? However, obviously, the technology does not protect you from certain things. Even when there's a shock, you still have losses, and you may need, hence, to protect yourself from those. Other instruments, such as precautionary savings or emergency index loans, which I'm going to explore. And then if you have very large shocks, well, the rice is going to die anyway because it's more than 15 days of flooding, in which case you need index insurance or social safety nets, right? So the second experience is we work with BRAC, which is, the largest NGO in the world, based in Bangladesh, has a lot of experience with the microfinance, has tried index insurance. Index insurance has failed, and they removed the product. So they were interested in introducing other products. And so what we explored with them is to introduce emergency loans, which are going to be inducing both then risk coping, namely people having access to those emergency loans are going to be able to react to shocks in a different way, but also, again, they are going to reoptimize. And we want to see what kind of impact this is having, both ex post through the payments that are going to be made, through the credit which is going to be taken, and ex ante in terms of behavior, right? So this is for flooding risk. It's going to be triggered. The eligibility is to have a credit score with BRAC that is qualifying you for an ex ante loan. Notice that you're going to engage into microfinance lending under the worst conditions. When people are hit by a shock, their repayment capacity is quite low, so you better select the better clients to make sure that the repayment is going to happen, right? The trigger is just like in index insurance, when some kind of event that can be tracked and observed and verified is going to happen. Here, this is the level in particular river, the level of the water in particular rivers, right? And then the pre-approval is that a credit line is announced to those selected clients that they can borrow up to a certain amount, which is predetermined, which is based on previous loans that they have had in the past, right? So the advantage is that there's no trust problem like in index insurance, because actually you're not paying anyone. You're just, you have a credit line, but there's no payment which is being made. There's no recency problem in the sense that if, as we know with index insurance, if no payment is being made, people kind of get discouraged from buying index insurance, and we see a decline in the interest in buying the product. Then there's no liquidity problem as with index insurance, since nothing is being paid. The problem is, of course, if shocks are very large, credit may not be sufficient. If shocks are recurrent, you're going to decapitalize yourself and credit is. So in a sense, you're internalizing the risk instead of exporting it. And so internalization has limits, which is your own ability to deal with shocks, including having access to credit, right? So we design a randomized control trial. BRAC has 3,000 branches. We take 100 branches to which where we offer the product, 100 where we don't, and we have the typical randomized control trial. And we see, again, this kind of exposed and ex ante risk shopping, risk coping effects. We see that there is less decapitalization, there's less sacrifice in consumption, the kind of responses that Michael was talking about. And then you have risk management effects ex ante, which is there's more investment in agriculture, there's more cultivated land, etc. What's interesting is that here it's the area which is insured, not the yield. And as a consequence, the way farmers respond is to produce more area as opposed to increasing the yield. Right? And then the last one is using index insurance as a social safety net. This is the Cadena program. So this was done with Daniel like Fonden as part of his World Bank DFID project. The Cadena program is one where the insurance is provided for free to farmers, smallholder farmers, who have less than 20 hectares of land and who are producing insurable crops, which are here corn, beans, sorghum, and barley, which is kind of the bread and butter of Mexican agriculture. Right? So the program was rolled out over starting in 2011, and it now covers 4.5 million smallholder farmers, 10.5 million hectares. So it's a really big program. It's one of these kind of success stories of index insurance at the farmer level, but it isn't free to the farmers, so there's 100% uptake. It essentially is a way of managing the financing of the social protection, where you rely on an insurance scheme as opposed to disbursing from federal budgets or engaging in a funding type management of liquidity ex ante relative to shocks. Right? So this is how it happens during the three periods of the growing of the corn. On the left hand, this is by municipality. The horizontal axis are the thresholds of rainfall. This is an insurance against drought. The lower curve is the daily rainfall. The blue lines are the cumulative. So when the cumulative crosses the rainfall, nothing happens. But as you can see on the right-hand side, sometimes the cumulative does not, and then the insurance is triggered out. Right? So it's an insurance which has sort of all the beauties of indexing in the sense that there's no more hazard, there's no adverse selection, and there's very rapid disbursements once you simply verify at the level of the experiment station that there has been, that the triggers have been activated. Right? So we essentially use, again, like what Alejandro has done, a regression discontinuity. And this is the probability on the left-hand side of receiving a payment. And you see there's kind of this cheating or this mistargeting. And sometimes there are payments to people who should not be receiving. And there are all the situations where there's payment to people who are receiving. So this is what we call a fuzzy regression discontinuity. But at the end, what we find is that it does have an impact. It has an impact on area planted the year after the shock compared to the control communities, the ones which are just below the threshold. It has an impact on expenditures on inputs, about 25% increase, and it has an impact on farm income. Has no impact on yield, again, because it's the area which is insured as opposed to the yield. And it has an impact on remittances, which is interesting. That is the way families compensate or help the parents who are being hit by a shock if we are remittances, especially coming from California or from Texas. And once you have a public insurance system, that in a sense it relieves the family from internalizing the burden of helping families respond to shocks, right? So the conclusions on Cadena is that index insurance can effectively be used as a national social safety net to help smallholder farmers cope with shocks. It provides them with resources to plant, so this is the ex-post response. It also protects their consumption, this is the ex-post response. It reduces the burden of private transfer, this is the ex-post response. But it also has the ex-ante response, the risk management effect, which I think is always really important to bear in mind, that we do not measure here because the identification strategy is not adequate for this, right? The program is probably expensive, but since we do not measure the risk management component, we only have the risk coping instrument, we cannot actually calculate the cost-benefit analysis. So this is my last slide. I'm not going to explain the graph, but let me just conclude with what's written, namely that it's quite likely that we have tried to oversell the index insurance in offering it to farmers for shocks which are too small and too frequent, when in fact those shocks should be covered with other risk-reducing, risk management and risk-coping instruments. And what we have explored here is the role of technology, resilient technology. What we have explored here is the role of emergency loans that can be designed and triggered, just like in index insurance, to be available for qualified borrowers in response to crisis. And we have also looked at how index insurance can be applied at a different level, which is here at the level of the states and the municipalities, where it acts basically as a social safety net instrument, allowing the states, the governors of the states, and the mayors of the municipality not to decapitalize their budget to respond to shocks and to protect, as a consequence, their educational and health and infrastructure budget as a consequence. So my punchline is that we need to kind of pay more attention to the totality of the instruments that are available to manage risk and clearly place within those where index insurance has a comparative advantage. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It was perfectly on time. So now we have time for Madeleine Latapie, who works at AXA Global Parametrics, so a big player in the insurance world, to discuss, to tell us what you think about what we have heard. Sure. So.
So first of all, I just want to thank the speakers and thank you for your research. It's extremely interesting. It's extremely important, I think, to be able to do these types of studies and see the effects that index insurance has in developing countries and in different populations. Clearly, I think what I've understood from the different presentations is that index insurance clearly has benefits. It clearly works. We've seen benefits both in terms of, Michael Carter's study said it quite well, in terms of, you know, less expenses and less damage to a family after a disaster, and then changing also their investments for the future. AXA Global Parametrics, we've been working for a few years already on looking at what are some different ways to make index insurance work. We look at working with governments. We look at working with international institutions. We have kind of an unique strategy in the market because we're working with corporations. So we're working with businesses on their weather risk. And we're also working with developing countries and working with international institutions for smallholder farmers. So in a sense, our portfolio is quite diversified. And we've identified, farmers in developing countries as potential emerging middle class clients, because if we see that if we provide them with index insurance in the medium to long term, they're going to become an emerging middle class. And so for us as a international insurer, we see it as a sort of a logical move to, you know, be in this space in a sort of non-profitable area in the short run. Clearly, we see that the index insurance only works if it's affordable for the farmer. Clearly, we're not going to be loading a bunch of uncertainty into our pricing. Our interest is to make it the least expensive possible. For that, we're working with very sophisticated data providers such as the NASA and others with the most resolution in their satellite images, which is usually what we use. So that's reducing various risks, reducing basis risk, for example, reducing uncertainty loading from our side because we're quite confident also in the data and in the future models. We're also, from our years of experience, we've clearly seen that in order to reduce costs, the best approach for us to use, at least, is this meso approach. So we're not going to be going directly to the client and trying to use our own distribution channels. That would just be too timely, too costly. So it's important for us to identify local players that could distribute the product and that we could work with. So I was interested in finding out more from the distribution side, what is the or what have you seen from your research is the best approach to insure the client in case of an event? Is it, to pay them in cash directly a few days after an event? Is it to combine this in another type of package? Is it to provide consulting plus a payment? That's sort of my question for the researchers.
Okay, so who wants to start to answer to Madeleine?
Go ahead. Oh, you want me to go? Okay. You have, I have the mic. No, that's a great question. A couple of layers in it, I think. I think we actually had a very fascinating discussion this morning about an issue that hasn't really come up yet today, but deserves mention, which is if farmers are insured in an event which is becoming increasingly non-viable, say because of climate change, does insurance sort of falsely keep them doing something or doing too much of something? The examples we gave earlier were of people not doing enough of something profitable, but a concern out there about insurance is, especially if it's subsidized, it's that people might keep doing it. So in the pastoralist regions, the Horn of Africa, you might say, well, it's time for those people to find out something else to do. And so that's an issue that's important. Now, in that particular context, we've always been thinking very strongly about paying people in cash. And the reason is it's portable, it's fungible, and we recognize that the world is changing, and at some point, families may, in fact, it may be sensible for them to exit and move into another realm of activity. So cash has that ability to let someone exit a crisis where they've lost 45 or 55 or sometimes in that region even 65% of their livestock have perished, and yet if they can exit that crisis with the cash value, then they can move on. On the other hand, in some interlinked or meso level products, it's often considered very important to have the insurance payment, say, go directly to the meso level provider. So I mentioned briefly work with the cotton value chains in West Africa, and there the payment is first applied to the debt that the farmer has incurred with the lending institution, and that's kind of important for a number of reasons, including maintaining credit worthiness, et cetera. Interestingly, there was just a project some people at Ohio State did in Ghana, where they rolled out experimentally different forms of credit-linked insurance, and they found something really quite interesting. So they found that number one, having insurance that paid off to the bank actually increased the loan approval rate for men borrowers. It actually had no effect on women borrowers. Their interpretation is because the lenders already trust women and they don't actually trust men. And they figured women are going to pay back no matter what, and men apparently are a little sketchier, except for Alan, who's a good guy, but maybe the rest of us are less so. But the other thing is they found that the demand for those kind of contracts amongst women when the payment was going to go directly to the lender, that actually killed the demand on the part of women. And I'm not quite sure what that makes, but it does. I think it speaks to another dimension of a trust issue, that seemingly women in that particular. Dip and take the insurance money, plus they're going to lean on me to pay or something like that. So I'm not quite sure. Again, the study can't really exactly tell us what was going on, but I think it's, I mention it because it's useful, I think, in thinking through some of the complexities of what some of the different payment options might entail.
Those are three really good points, and let me try to elaborate a bit on each. The first one is not to insure individuals, but to insure some kind of institutional level. And the way you want to target the institution is to select an institution that is able to engage into mutual insurance, namely that knows enough about who are the others in the group, there's trust within the group, and there's information about relative losses within the group. So you insure the co-op, and then you let the co-op distribute the payment which has been made based on observable relative damages of the members of the cooperative. So we ran an experiment like this in Guatemala. Everybody loved it. The members wanted it to happen. But they say we don't trust the cooperative as to how they are going to distribute the funds. And in the end, the experiment was satisfactory in terms of willingness to move towards cooperative level insurance, but not effectively engaging into putting into place the product. The second is the issue of subsidies, and what you are saying in a sense is that you are, and this is really a good perspective on the side of AXA, you see a future market in smallholder farmers emerging into the middle class, and they are going to create a demand for other kinds of insurance, health, automobile insurance, and whatever, to where your big markets are really placed. So the question is, how do you use subsidies in order to create those markets? And what you want is what we call smart subsidies. You want to kind of minimize the subsidies, and you want not only to minimize them in terms of amount, but in terms of the time that where the subsidies are going to be sustained. So what you can do is you can look at behavior, and you can target the subsidies and calibrate the subsidies to always be sort of minimum cost. So we did this with the government of China that wanted to engage into an experiment for a few years. So they gave us a number of villages where we could experiment with the scheme, and now it's a national scheme that has been unleashed. And the subsidies are sort of annually calibrated to recent events. If you have had a disaster the year before and you observe payouts to either yourself or to peers, then the year after there's going to be a very high demand for insurance. So you can reduce the subsidies very, very substantially. If you have had a series of years where there has been no event, then people start to believe, well, you know, God is with me, I don't need to buy insurance. And so you have actually to increase the subsidies in order to compensate for the fact that there has been no recent event. So what you can do is kind of use the learning process as to how do farmers accept to pay for index insurance, and then calibrate correspondingly your subsidies. So subsidies, I think, are a very good idea, but one has to be careful that you always want them to be smart, namely to have a way out and to kind of minimize the cost of those. And the last one is whether those payments should be in cash or something else. So I agree with Michael that likely they should be in cash, but there are situations where there's market failure. And this is exactly the analogous to foreign aid. Should foreign aid be in cash or in kind? Well, it depends if there are market failures. If there are market failures, then you want to move out of cash and transfer the foreign assistance in products which are going to compensate for failing markets. So here, if there are market failures, for example, for seeds, and you have had a disaster, farmers have lost their crops, cannot replant, there is no market for seeds, then you want to have kind of assistance in terms of getting the seed value chain in place. The same maybe with technical assistance. If they have actually had no experience with how to rebuild farming systems, then so yes, cash, but if markets fail or if institutional support is not available, public institutional support, then you want to maybe move beyond cash and transfer your, organize your transfers in a different fashion.
Thanks a lot. Madeleine, do you want just to make a quick comment on that? Or
no, I mean, I think those insights were really really interesting, really helpful, and I don't think I have anything to add.
Okay, so now we have time for some questions. If you have questions, don't be shy.
Bonjour. Désolé, je vais parler en français. mon anglais n'est pas très bon. Et, je ne sais pas si vous pouvez traduire pour ceux qui font la présentation. Et, donc, merci pour les deux présentateurs. Merci aux professeurs, aux deux professeurs. Et ma question est plutôt pour le professeur Carter. Et lorsqu'il a proposé vers la fin le lien entre l'assurance et le crédit, lorsqu'il a proposé vers la fin une solution qui consisterait à, en tout cas, à accroître la prise de l'assurance en faisant le lien entre le crédit et l'assurance. Et mon inquiétude est que cette solution puisse être perverse en quelque sorte. C'est-à-dire qu'on est dans des situations, par exemple, dans une zone de l'Afrique de l'Ouest, telle qu'il a évoqué, en ce qui concerne l'assurance récolte au Sahel, où on a des niveaux de revenus qui sont relativement bas. Aider au crédit à cause de leur coût. S'il faudrait encore ajouter le coût de l'assurance, la prime d'assurance plus le taux d'intérêt, malheureusement, je me rends compte que ça va davantage démotiver un certain nombre de producteurs à prendre l'assurance. D'ailleurs, je l'ai constaté avec mes étudiants sur le cas du Burkina Faso dans différents villages. On se rend compte que très souvent, ceux qui prennent l'assurance sont ceux qui sont déjà, on va dire, relativement aisés par rapport au niveau de vie du village et qui ont déjà l'habitude de prendre du crédit avec des montants relativement plus élevés. Donc, je ne sais pas qu'est-ce qu'ils proposent par rapport à cela, parce que ça reste relativement très compliqué dans le contexte burkinabé.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you for the translation help. So again, that's a very nice question. I guess the way I think Alan said it very nicely, that many of the benefits of insurance are actually from changes in ex-ante behavior. That is, somebody has an already profitable opportunity available to them. They could fertilize their crops more, they could expand the range of cultivation, but they're not taking advantage of it, perhaps because of risk. I think index insurance makes the most sense when, in fact, there is an opportunity, when farmers are behaving in such a way that they're not taking advantage of otherwise profitable opportunities. The example you gave of people who are sort of marginally profitable and therefore insurance makes it that much more expensive, then, you know, insurance is probably not the right solution in that kind of environment. Insurance as a device to protect people after a shock, yes. But asking farmers to pay for something that's expensive when it's not going to have any ability to crowd in a new money-making opportunity for the farmer is perhaps not the best idea. So I know when we think about where does index insurance make sense, the first question we ask ourselves is where are farmers' current risk coping strategies leading them to leave money on the table every year? When are they not exploiting an otherwise profitable opportunity? And that to us is the place that it makes a lot of sense to do index insurance. But again, that's not everywhere. It's not all crops. The work we've done in West Africa that's been, I think, fairly successful is actually a fairly profitable cash crop that may not be the case for certain kinds of food crops, which are marginally profitable. So I hope that gets to some of your question, but be happy to speak more.
It's quite interesting that a lot of the work in international development has started with credit, with microfinance, the microfinance revolution, so-called. And what we realize is that if an innovation is profitable, then quite often people are going to find how to get access to liquidity in order to acquire the innovation. Think of the cell phone. Right? Cell phone was a major revolution, are not cheap, and yet most people bought them without credit. But in the rice experiment that we got, once the technology was available and farmers realized that it's profitable and they invested more, there was no credit, particular credit, that was made available to them. And there's a famous experience in Ghana that Carl and Udry and others did, where they offered credit, they offered insurance, and they offered both. And what you see is that the big hit is offering insurance. And once you have offered insurance, offering credit in addition to insurance basically adds nothing to what the insurance is doing. So this issue that we are discussing here, insurance and the lack of insurance for many of the initiatives that farmers take, is really a very big issue, which is still only partially resolved.
Madeleine, you want to say something? No, it's fine. So I think we are running out of time. There is one more question, maybe? Okay.
Hello, I'm Amélie, a risk officer at AFD. Thank you very much for the presentations. Very interesting. Insurance is a key topic, especially in a continent like Africa, where obviously assets, insured assets are a very small proportion of national product. Actually, a question for AFD, maybe Philippe. What is our own experience in the field of insurance? You know, good experience, bad experience, if you can maybe give us a bit of overview. And maybe a question to Madeleine as well, for at AXA, what are the, what effectively prevents insurance from expanding more? I know it's a very broad question. In a continent like Africa, what are the main key factors that makes the whole subject a bit more complicated? Thank you.
From my end first? Sure. And I think one of the biggest, and now I'm just talking from an index insurance perspective because I'm part of the Global Parametrics team. We try to leverage really our network, our local network on the African continent. We have, various AXA offices throughout the continent. I think as we've seen in other presentations, this is sort of a newer type of insurance. One of our biggest problems in the past was data, but that's becoming more and more, sophisticated, and we see huge improvements on that level. The bigger challenge is on the demand side, I'd say, today, from the individual farmers. So from a trust perspective and from other issues that we mentioned, earlier in the day. Occasionally, some regulatory constraints. It takes time. I think those are the biggest barriers today. Yeah.
So, and for the IFD, so... from the research part, we didn't do so much right now on index insurance specifically, and from the operation part, so I am not from the operation, so I cannot tell you a lot, but I know that we have done some projects about like micro level insurance in Africa in the past, and now we are working quite a lot with ARC, so there is someone from ARC in the room, so you can ask question maybe during the break, which is like more a macro level insurance, so for the states. So we are doing some work, at least from the operations, and I think you have to ask them for more information because I don't want to tell you bad information.